Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we get a peek at the final exhibition at Bentley Gallery and a look inside wilderness therapy for teens and the troubled teen industry. But first, it's time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We could be effective in either winning or at least changing the outcome enough that the candidates running recognize that they need to appeal to the center if they want to win.
Just part and parcel of the Trump administration wanting to use personal data as a weapon. It's going to intimidate vulnerable families and discourage them from seeking basic help.
Well, listen, Arizona is the swingiest swing states of all those states. So, first of all, no one talks about the fact that I move all over Arizona a gazillion times.
He was a brilliant organizer, a fantastic agitator against the status quo. At the same time, he was a legislative powerhouse who knew how to work inside the system.
This morning, I am joined by two politicos from both sides of the aisle. We have Sam Richard, Democratic consultant with Consilium Consulting, and GOP pollster Paul Bentz of High Ground. Good morning to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, let's Friday Newscap. So I want to start with the No Labels Party. It's back in the news this week, and they're joining the folks behind Make Elections Fair AZ. This was the failed ballot initiative to create open primaries in our state last year. And they say they want to recruit moderate independent candidates to run up and down the ticket. There are often more independents in Arizona than members of the two parties, right, Paul? So tell us about how this might play.
Sure. Right now, there's 1.5 million folks that registered as other. There is not technically an independent party in the state. In fact, there's just people that choose no label, not no labels, but party not designated or PND or chose none. They're the second largest group in the state, second only to Republicans. And so it's a large portion of the audience that has been the determiner of the outcomes of many of the elections. The irony here is this is not an open primary. This is them choosing to, if you can't beat them, join them.
Right.
Join the No Labels Party and try to make some reform from the inside.
Sam, are there, have we ever seen a successful third party in the state? Like, how would that work? What are the kind of hurdles to even getting there?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that it depends on how you define success.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that third parties have definitely, you know, made the waters murkier for, you know, the candidates in the general election from either party. And I think that the jury's still out about which party this is going to hurt more, whether a Republican on the general ballot, that, you know, those voters who may be disaffected in that primary might choose that No Labels candidate, or what, you know, may be just as likely, if not a touch more likely, is that the Democrats might feel a little bit more pressure trying to battle, you know, someone who is appealing to that middle, because most of the statewide Democrats in recent history that have had success at a general election ballot have gone to that middle to approach those disaffected Republicans. And I think that's where some of the existential concern is happening right now.
Right, because the whole concern was that the primaries and the parties in the primaries are just catering to the extremes. That's what this is trying to remedy. But you're saying once you get to the general, that's fixed anyway.
Correct.
Sam, I want to ask, though, Paul, are independent voters really independent when it comes down to voting?
There's no single independent. They're not like-minded. Everyone assumes they're all moderate. But,
yeah.
I mean, one of the things to think about is this. If you wanted to run without a party, if you wanted to run as a quote-unquote independent right now, you need 42,000 signatures to qualify for the statewide ballot.
Wow.
If you run as a no-labels candidate, you only need 1,300 signatures.
Hmm.
So as somebody who doesn't want to be of the two parties, this is an excellent opportunity to get on the ballot and overcome some of those significant barriers that the two parties have set in place. And the challenge here is, ultimately, do they become the place where independent and unaffiliated voters, the folks that have chosen traditionally not to be of the two parties, come together and vote for those candidates? Or do they play more of a spoiler alert? I mean, Democrats have, as Sam mentioned, benefited from the folks that choose not to be or be willing to vote for a MAGA candidate.
Right.
And so they've benefited from disaffected Republicans, moderate-leaning independents, do those folks go to a no labels candidate or somebody like that at the detriment of Democrats?
And there were some very tight races last time around.
Absolutely. Yeah. Within hundreds of votes. Right. So, you know, we're going to absolutely see this make an effect on the election. I think there's still a big question as to what, but I'm just loving the irony that the no labels group is going to have to actually choose a label. They're going to have to name themselves
they'll have
something.
A name, yeah.
And I do think that, you know, both Democrats and Republicans are in a moment right now where, you know, different sections of voters from either party have a different definition of what it means to be a Democrat or what it means to be a Republican.
Right.
I think that there's a lot of folks that, you know, are disaffected by President Trump in a lot of ways and don't think that he represents the Republican brand. So it's not just the Democrats that are in disarray. I think that we really are in a transitive moment in the American political discourse.
Yeah. Also, this is not new. I mean, we've seen for years Green Party candidates tended to run and harm Democrats, Libertarian candidates, third parties tended to harm Republicans and play a little bit of a spoiler. The question here is, do they field a full field of candidates? Do they run someone for some of these big statewide offices? Do they have a bigger impact bringing more people to the table that we haven't seen in the past that maybe have some real interest in? It should push policy forward in a way for people to pay attention or at least understand what's going on. It just is not the two-party monolith fighting against one another. It does give people a real alternative.
Is it all about money then?
That definitely plays a huge part, but I think that at some point, kind of like, you know, in personal finance, after a certain time, you know, money doesn't really make you any happier, right? I think perhaps we have reached in the political realm, you know, a full saturation of dollars, and at that point, really, it may become a battle of ideas or maybe a war of attrition, depending on how pessimistic you want to be. But I do think that money will play a factor, because to become relevant in what will likely become the most expensive gubernatorial race in Arizona's history, you know, does a no labels candidate actually break through?
Does anyone have any sense at this point who these candidates might be?
No, I mean, that's what was really interesting to see is, you know, there's two parts. There's money and then there's message. And when you become a party, when you become a group, a collection of people that you're trying to attract other people, you do have to have a message. And what is the message that they bring forward? Do they weigh in on particular issues? Because once you start putting issues together, where they stand on abortion, where they stand on immigration, where they stand on economic policy, but also, you know, candidates do better when they're running against a generic opposition, right? Would you vote for so-and-so or a Republican? In those cases, what the polling shows is the generic ideal candidate typically does better. But when you have an actual name on the ballot, it'll be interesting to see who they attract. Can they get attractive candidates to be competitive in some of these races?
Okay. I want to move to a story that is kind of riling folks up this week. Our friend Jen Fifield with VoteBeat got some text messages released to her via a public records request that show that Maricopa County Recorder Justin Heap seemed to have pressured two county supervisors, Debbie Lesko and Mark Stewart, to give him more election power. And Paul, it looks like there might be more text messages to be released still, right?
Well, this is the latest example of Republican on Republican crime. And I think it's important to note that both Debbie Lesko, as well as Stewart, as well as Galvin, who with the end around was trying to get around, they're all incredibly conservative Republicans. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing one Republican attack some other ones and say, I'm done with you. And you know, these threats here just sort of create this unhealthy environment and create uncertainty about how the election is going to be operated. But it shouldn't be lost. The fact that the original change on what the recorder is responsible for was a response from a Republican Board of Supervisors trying to limit the amount of power that the then Democratic recorder Adrian Fontes would have over the elections.
Right.
And so now he's trying to claw it back.
Right. So this is Republican on Republican, but we're also seeing some pretty strong responses from the one Democrat on the board.
Yeah, absolutely. Supervisor Gallardo had some very terse responses to some of the accusations that were made now publicly, though initially privately. But I think, you know, even beyond some of the partisan scuffle, you know, really this is politics 101. And I think that perhaps Recorder Heap might be well served by picking up a copy of Dale Carnegie's classic, How to Win Friends and Influence Others, because this, you know, he clearly attempted to outmaneuver Chairman Galvin and failed miserably, and including a text message that said, "I sure hope that these texts don't show up in a public records request."
Right.
So just there's so many laugh lines, but I think that Maricopa County is well served by the Board of Supervisors and will continue to do so.
Right. So let me ask you lastly on this one, like we have midterms coming up pretty fast here, and they're going to be consequential, tight races, important races. What does this all mean for how our elections might run, which has, you know, been a problem in the past?
Well, we had a consequential special election in which there was some controversy around that. I think voters want certainty, and they want, you know, that's something that I think that's what the supervisors are aiming for. They've been very firm and steady all the way through, fighting against election deniers, pushing back against concerns and complaints that were not founded. And this is just the latest example of that. And, you know, they need to find a way to come together and compromise. And that's the challenge that we see in some of these places, is that, you know, they're rather misrepresent who they've negotiated with and what the deal is, as well as doing it all via text. I mean, whatever happened to the days that people actually sat down face to face and tried to actually work things out and negotiate?
What does this do for voter confidence, though, in elections, these kind of stories that come out?
I think it shakes it to a certain extent, but I also am hopeful that, you know, this is August 1st of an off year. So perhaps, you know, they can figure out their internal squabbles before we get there. And I think to Paul's point, though, I want to drive that home that, you know, voters do want certainty, because what we do as a democracy is every 2 years we go to our local fire station and local school and overthrow our government. And when you're doing something so dramatic as that, you want the kind of the framework of the rules of engagement set well in advance. And I think that voters are going to have that. And this is just a blip in the grand scheme of things. I think the voters will have certainty come November 26th.
All right. We're going to go to a break. More of the Friday News Cap after this. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I am Lauren Gilger. And now back to the Friday News Cap. I am joined this morning by GOP pollster Paul Benz with High Ground, Sam Richard, Democratic consultant with Consilium Consulting. Thanks to you both for being here. And let's jump back in with Ruben Gallego. Arizona's junior senator is making a lot of waves through the political world. He's gone to Iowa. Now he has gone to New Hampshire. And these are, of course, telltale signs of someone who is about to make a presidential run. Sam, from the Democratic side of the aisle, are you expecting to see Gallego run for president?
I would welcome him as a part of the conversation. But frankly, I think with this far ahead of his next reelection, he really has some flexibility and some freedom to make some reaches and take some risks from a political standpoint. Mm-hmm. That being said, you know, it wouldn't be the first time that a senator from Arizona threw their hat in the ring for a presidential consideration. But on top of everything, I think here's a couple of things that I think about. One, he has the gravitas, and he has the political machinations to be able to be a serious force in a conversation like one around a presidential ticket. But another thing is, it really puts Arizona on a map, and we are the center of conversations in business communities and in political communities nationally, if not internationally. So this is really, in a lot of ways, us taking the mantle that was first set up, like people like Senator McCain and Senator Goldwater, that put Arizona on a map, and otherwise little podunk, you know, Western state with only, you know, cowboy hat wearing, you know, horse riders, right? So I think that we really are in this midst of transitioning from a red tile roof economy to a powerhouse of advanced manufacturing and the political center of the future, right? Arizona is a microcosm of the American discourse, and we've seen that time and ahead. You know, we are 10 to 15 years ahead of many political machinations nationally, and I think that time window is closing a little bit. So someone like Senator Gallego will be president in the future, and I think that Senator Gallego is well prepared to do so himself.
What did he call it in that cut? It was the swingiest of swing states.
That's right.
Right.
Paul, he's been doing some interesting things. Like, watching him kind of meet this political moment has been very interesting. He's talking about Latino men wanting big trucks and how the Democratic Party needs to talk to real people about what they're really concerned about. Is that what voters want?
Well, I mean, he's one of the very few bright spots in a 2024 where Democrats did abysmally, not only in Arizona, but across the country. And I think he's showed a template of being, you know, a more genuine human. One of the statement says it over and over, and he's the kind of guy you would like to have a beer with, you know, and he says what's on his mind, and he's bucked the system a little bit on some of the positions he's taken on some of these issues. That's actually infuriated his own party, and I think that's to his own benefit. You know, he's still fairly young. I think that part of this is strategically very smart just to get into the mentioning game. Sometimes folks don't run. They don't actually end up being the nominee the first time they run. But getting into that mentioning cycle, getting making those connections, starting to grow that base of support long term is incredibly brilliant to do that now early in the game. He's got young children still. I'm not sure this is necessarily the time that he'll run and just in the next few years. But certainly, I think he's a name to keep in mind. He's got the right background, you know, the blue collar upbringing, serving in the military. He's got a lot of things that appeal to a broader portion of the audience. And that's what I think he's talking about when he says Democrats would need to listen to, quote unquote, real people. I mean, getting away from some of sort of the intellectual and outrage and starting to put some, you know, things together and actually having some, you know, policies to move forward with and a vision of what can be done, I think is really helpful as a guiding star for Democrats and somebody that other folks can look to.
Sam, does this look like what does this look like, I guess, in a post-Trump Republican Party? Is this the kind of candidate that can go up against them?
I mean, I think clearly he was a candidate that went, you know, same ballot as Trump and out, you know, paced any of his colleagues across the country that also ran for statewide office in that time in terms of overperforming what the average Democrat did on the ticket. And to Paul's point about, you know, the rest of the Democrats nationwide that had abysmal performances, I think that whether or not Senator Gallego decides to run, his success on a recent ballot is going to inform the direction, the conversation of the presidential race. And I think that it's important for him to be a part of the dialogue and the discourse so he can push other potential candidates like Mayor Buttigieg, which now Secretary Buttigieg, I suppose, or, you know, Gina Raimondo or any other name that is starting to float. You can kind of know that Senator Gallego was the most recent victor. So let's talk about what your playbook looked like and maybe shape that into a presidential campaign in 2026.
I think the other thing is he's just not afraid of this, you know, who he's gone up against time and again. I mean, he's sort of a rough and tumble personality. I mean, he says it, tells it like it is. I mean, I think he's calmed down on social media a little bit, but you know, if you look at his old social media, it was pretty forward and pretty aggressive. And I think there's folks that are looking for that. I mean, I think that's one of the things that Trump's put forward is basically attack, 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 and then only pull back when you have to. And I think overall what's been the Democratic response is be outraged, be outraged, be outraged, and just sort of respond. I think, you know, he's somebody that can go toe-to-toe with some of these post-Trump Republicans. And I think that's something that Democrats need. They need someone who can stand up and sort of push back on that, not just respond and be outraged by what they're saying.
Right. So, Sam, what do you think this means and the way he's doing politics right now, right, means for the future of the Democratic Party? Because it's a little bit in disarray, as we have mentioned. But is the answer to out-Trump Trump?
I don't think it's necessarily to out-Trump Trump, but I think it's to pick up on the things that voters are responsive to. And I think that beyond partisanship, I think whether or not in our personal relationships or professional relationships, and especially in our political relationships, we value integrity. We value someone who is authentic. And I think that for the last 15 to 20 years, we haven't really seen a lot of authenticity in our elected leaders. And I think that was really this thread that the first Trump campaign was really pulling at, right? Like, I'm your guy. I'm, you know, I've been through these struggles. And whether or not there was any integrity in that, there was authenticity in that. And, you know, you have national Democratic voices like, you know, AOC, the congresswoman from New York, or you know, even recent attempts from Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, to kind of go on those right-leaning podcasts and try to, you know, intense. I think that voters are very responsive to someone who is exactly who they are and doesn't hide that, and that is Senator Gallego to a T.
Authentic is the word of the day. Speaking of, okay, we lost a big name in Arizona political history this week, Alfredo Gutierrez. He's being remembered as this firebrand and activist for the Latino community, for immigrants. but also as somebody who really crossed the aisle, like was, you know, a leader in the state legislature for a long time and was able to make a difference even in the minority. He was also a mentor to a lot of progressives in our state, and those folks have been talking about him all week. And it makes me think about the political leadership in the future today and the future of the Democratic Party in the state. Who is next to take up that helm?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, it's like a coaching tree in the NFL when you talk about like Bill Walsh or Bill Belichick, where you have these coaches that all came up together and you see them on the squad as the assistant coach or as the offensive coordinator or whatever. Jameson Gutierrez, when I got into this business, was one of the preeminent names of Democratic strategy and one of the big firms that I think cast off a lot of people over time that are still around today. And the question is, are they the next mantle picking things up? Who in that lineage maybe can be part of the conversation as because they did it right and they knew how to do it. Like you said, even was effective even when they were in the Democratic majority or minority. And I think that's what the biggest is: who's in charge, who's going to lead, who's got experience in winning, who's got experience in strategy. I feel like these days, both sides of the aisle, both Republicans and Democrats, some of those younger consultants, strategists, people that have run for office, they run one or two campaigns and they think they know everything. And, you know, Republicans really like to fight and Democrats really like to react and respond. But that actual strategy, the things that Alfredo brought to the table are things that were really well strategized and something that Democrats need to get back to.
Right. And we're talking about a Democratic Party in the state that just kicked out their chair, right?
That's right. Yeah. And you know, in your lead-in about Lita Gutierrez, you talked about his well-deserved and well-renowned role in activism. Mm-hmm. But he also walked and chewed gum at the same time as well. He was probably one of the most effective legislators in Arizona history. He served at the same time as the legendary Burton Barr, who was so legendary that it said that, you know, 89 other people got to serve at the same time as Burton Barr. Right? But Leader Gutierrez, who was the minority leader for most of his career, except for one session that he was the majority leader, understood that dynamic from a strategic and really kind of well-prepared standpoint, so much so that when there was a close vote that the Republicans knew they were going to need Democratic votes, you would say, I'm going to go shopping at Alfredo's store, because he always had an amendment. He always had a provision that could be added to something. So yes, he absolutely was an activist and he was vocal and he was out front on important issues of the day, but he also didn't let an understanding of where we were as a state and the political power centers, and used that was almost kind of like using the gravity of the moon to get back to Earth, right? Like he understood the dynamics of making the art of the possible, in addition to being a really, really great activist. And I think that perhaps one of the legacies of Leader Gutierrez, because he will have many, will be inspiring people to be both vocal and strategic. And I think far too often in my party, I won't speak for Paul's, but in my party, we've had folks choose one or the other.
Right.
And I think that what Alfredo can remind us all that both are possible.
Right. And especially in this moment, last 30 seconds here, Paul, what's the legacy coming from Alfredo from your point of view?
I think Sam hit the nail on the head. I think it's being vocal and being strategic. I think both gets lost these days, especially with social media. You know, I just think so much of it is people don't even listen anymore. They're waiting for their turn to speak. And he is certainly somebody who listened. And he'll be missed significantly. I think as we see a lot of the old leaders retire, some of them pass away. I also think of like Congressman Ed Pastor and others. Mm-hmm. They're not being replaced by other statesmen. And I think Alfredo was a statesman.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for today. That is the Friday News Cap. That was GOP pollster Paul Benz with High Ground, Sam Richard with Consilium Consulting. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a new documentary profiles the survivors and victims of the troubled teen industry. But first, a new photo exhibition at a Phoenix gallery spans largely from shortly after the 2008 election through last year's election day. It's called American Hypnosis, and the photographer behind it calls it a series of surreal postcards, a feeling of familiar uneasiness transmitted from a citizen who is equally intrigued by his home as he is alarmed. Jesse Reeser's exhibit will be on display at Bentley Gallery through the end of August. In fact, this will be the last show at that space, which is closing after a long run as one of the Valley's most notable art spots. Reeser spoke with my co-host, Mark Brody, who started the conversation by asking how he describes the exhibit.
So this is a project that it started to sort of ruminate, and it, you know, this is actually, it's a privilege, third time I've been here talking with you. The other two projects, one on Christmas and the closing American Suburban Mall, those are very topical and, like, I don't want to say on face value. This was something I started to feel post the 2008 election as this feeling that was kind of abstract. It was a feeling that I think isn't uncommon. I grew up in the Ozarks, and some say the buckle of the Bible Belt, and there was these, you know, these feelings that things were shifting in a space that felt kind of dark, and I think also kind of rooted in this sensation that I was feeling like a foreigner in my homeland, even though I love these places and these people dearly.
So were these photographs, this series of photographs, an effort to help you try to understand the place and the people?
Yes and no. I think it's more of a facsimile of a feeling. You know, I think about this in correlation with sort of this rise of over-democratization of everything from art to media and where you so choose to get your news. But a byproduct of that yields something that feels like you have these sort of different realities that sort of, you know, placate to one's belief system in these echo chambers. And so with that, everything started to feel a little bit like a dream or deja vu. And so, you know, to create these images in this larger whole of the project, they kind of speak to these postcards that can be very beautiful, but also very unsettling. One part daydream, one part nightmare.
Yeah. How do you try to balance that, sort of the beauty and the upsettingness in one image?
So I think some of that can be, I don't want to say simple, but, you know, my visual language is very painterly and very illustrative, and it can feel almost something that's maybe a little like poppy and bright. But then, you know, the image or the scene itself within that can be a little dark and nuanced. And I think that adds to the sort of, like, again, this feeling of a dream or the surrealism, that it's at face value sort of pleasant. And then when you take a deeper look, there's a level of absurdity, commentary, and a darker nuance.
So, Jesse, let me ask you about a couple of the photos here. And there's one where it's five people, four of whom are sitting on what I assume is their back patio, staring at the eclipse from a few years back. They're all wearing glasses. What stands out to you about an image like this, which seems like something that you could probably have seen on the back patios of hundreds of thousands, if not more, households on that day?
So that's a good question. So in the show, what's important is how the images relate to one another. So that image is in reaction to the title image, which is this really intense spiral that really kind of hurts your eyes on this man's polo. And then it comes to this image of these five retirees, which is this really amazing place in southern Arizona. It's called Sky Village. And it's a retirement community brought together by the love of astronomy. And it's this really sort of sweet notion that, you know, people at maybe not the end of their life, but in their advanced years, they've, you know, their community is brought together by a love or a passion of something. And then after that image is this image of a girl in one of these, like, bungees sort of sending her up into the heavens. And it's almost like
a county fair kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's almost like they are with their solar shades sort of reacting to her ascending up towards the sky.
So one of the other photos you took that's in the show is four people, looks like part of like an old West kind of thing, walking down kind of a dusty street. I mean, this looks like it could have been one of the publicity photos for like Tombstone or something like that.
And that's where that is. And again, that's another thing, like creating this massive sprawling body of work. It's like the sum of the parts are sort of become the whole. And it's like, okay, this image, it's aesthetically, it's pleasing, but in the edit, it's opposite of a decommissioned nuclear warhead. And then before that is this four-story Jesus in Arkansas on top of Magnetic Mountain with his arms wide open. And again, sort of creating this visual vernacular where one sort of informs the other.
Did you notice any changes of any kind over those years that you were doing this? I mean, as we said, that's a pretty long period of time to be taking photographs on, even if it wasn't consciously on the same subject. In the end, they kind of came up on the same subject.
Yeah, I think themes in the last probably 5 or 6 years, and I'll just call a couple out if that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, one is a theme of suspicion, not only like as a person with camera, and this was something I noticed more after the 2016 election cycle, that distrust of media and journalists, but also this sort of suspicion of your fellow countrymen. There's a photograph in the show of these two young boys having an ice cream sitting on the floor, and they're looking at me with this like innocence, but also this like very wary eye of suspicion that I think is really powerful in the vignette in which it's displayed. The other is this word I keep coming back to, vanishing, the sort of collective fear of losing one's version of America. You know, it's like we all have our own versions of America, and somehow it's this unshareable entity. And in the show, there's a few images that speak to that. There's this empty diner table with the, like, it's just reeks of Americana with the red and white checkered vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a there's this blank billboard where it's white and the legs are red and the blue sky, and it feels like this sort of erased American flag. And then speaking to that sort of pushback and that conflict within these like versions of America, there's this one of a detail of a man's fist on a steering wheel, and there's a beer on the dash, and there's this real life hermit up above Cleeter in Arizona that is confronting him, and there's just this dynamic that just speaks, I think, to this like bigger feeling I and a lot of people have just about like that conflict and this sort of like American roadside.
So do you feel like you learned anything over the course of this project and coming into contact with the people with whom you came into contact?
You know, I do. I think there's this interesting thing that I keep noticing is that, like, optically things feel very tense, almost to a place that there's no reconciliation. But, like, when you talk to people, people still feel really good and pleasant. And sometimes I see those same people, you know, and it's not just of our generation or younger, but like even of our parents. And then the way they interact on a digital space can be so crass and sometimes mean. But in person, it's like it's just a different interaction. And again, I think it speaks back to this, these two versions of oneself or two versions of the country or what those perceived truths actually are.
Jesse Reeser is a photographer based in Phoenix. His exhibit called American Hypnosis will be on display at Bentley Gallery through August 30th. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. A new documentary film profiles survivors of the so-called troubled teen industry, which flourished in the 1980s and 90s. Over 100,000 kids nationwide were sent by their parents to a group of wilderness camps and self-proclaimed reform schools, which offered a regimen of intense physical conditioning, harsh military-style discipline, and group therapy sessions focused on shaming attendees for their past behavior.
A youngster who is going down in flames needs something tough to help him get back on track.
Give me one more minute.
Take control of it.
You gotta start answering questions.
It's not easy. It's not fun. It's tough love.
Filmmaker Michaela Schwer grew up in Phoenix. She remembers classmates at Central High School being sent to these programs. And in particular, she remembers one of them, Aaron Bacon, who died while attending a wilderness therapy retreat in Utah. Aaron's story stuck with Michaela, and 20 years later, her documentary, The Kids Are Not All Right, profiles three families whose lives were upended by their experience with similar programs. One of the film's subjects is Cynthia Harvey, a Phoenix mom whose daughter Erica died while attending a wilderness camp called the Catherine Freer School. My co-host Sam Dingman spoke with Harvey, as well as Schwer, the director.
I was looking for different types of stories. Obviously, we really wanted to have
experiences of people who went through it. So the kids who went through these programs. And so we do follow survivors. But I also thought it was really important to share a parent's story. You know, Cynthia had already been open about this. She had testified before Congress. And so we just started a conversation. It's, you know, not an easy thing to be in a documentary and share these stories. And so we started slowly and started a conversation from there.
Yeah. Cynthia, let me ask you, obviously, there's footage in the documentary of your testimony before Congress. It's a very powerful sequence in the film.
When Erica's eyes rolled into the back of her head and she fell off the trail head first into rocks and scrub brush, she was left to lie where she fell for 45 minutes while two FREER staffers, still unwilling or unable to recognize what was happening, watched Erica die a slow, painful death.
Can you talk a little bit about getting to the point where you didn't just feel comfortable speaking out, but it felt like something that was imperative to do?
Took a few years after Erica's death. First of all, it took probably 4 years or more to actually find out what exactly had happened to Erica, the many failures. So
this is something you speak about in the testimony that
right.
The wilderness facilitator didn't know the GPS coordinates of where they were.
Right. And so as we learned more and as I found out about the broader problem of the troubled teen industry, you know, once you know what you know, you can't unknow it. And I, you know, felt compelled.
In the film, we see you talking about the fact that the person who ran the school that your daughter went to was not really carefully vetting the people who were facilitating these wilderness programs. Is that what you're talking about when you say once we knew what we knew?
Oh, that and not carefully vetting the participants of the programs. You know, Erica should definitely have been drug tested, but also the color-changing nature of programs. They tell each applicant parents what they want to hear. When we placed Erica, you know, there was still a boot camp mentality at some places, you know, that was very upfront. And of course, we were horrified by that. But in practice, where Erica went was boot camp like enough to kill her. So
yeah,
it certainly wasn't what was presented to us.
Right. One of the things that you look at in the film are some of the cultural circumstances that created an appetite for these schools to exist, in particular the war on drugs. What else, in your opinion, Michaela, created an environment where these schools were able to expand and thrive?
I mean, I do think there were a couple different, you know, cultural factors. Certainly the war on drugs, even just kind of the satanic panic kind of idea.
Right.
You know, there were kids who were sent away literally just because they were wearing black nail polish. A lot of the behavior that kids were sent away for was very normal teenage behavior, you know, skipping class, like drinking a little bit.
What do you do if your child gets caught in a cycle of self-destructive or even dangerous behavior? Some desperate parents are turning to a drastic solution. They're having their children abducted, taken against their will to a tough behavior modification program.
Who are you?
These people, known as transporters, have been hired to sneak into this home and seize a 16-year-old.
We're gonna have to hold your arms to the car.
They got my wrists really quick behind my back. They've got flashlights, beanies, gloves. They literally was thrown in to the back of the truck. And we just disappeared.
Now, there are also kids who really, really needed help. And I think these places just marketed themselves as a one-stop shop for any problem your teen has.
And to be clear, these are for-profit institutions, right?
For-profit institutions that are very similar to, you know, private prison systems. They have to fill beds.
Right.
And it was also, you know, school counselors and educational consultants. And there was a whole industry built around it to funnel kids into these places.
Cynthia, if you're comfortable talking about it, what made you and your husband feel like the program that Erica went to was going to be a good choice?
Erica had been under the care of a psychiatrist and a psychologist, and we were told she needed a drug treatment program.
So, well, she was also, if I'm not mistaken, she was dealing with suicidal ideation.
Yes, she
right?
was. She was diagnosed as bipolar disorder, and now, of course, in so much retrospect of so many years, you know, you're like, why would you even think to send someone, you know, with bipolar disorder out in the wilderness? But there was a sense too that, you know, this was a short-term program. We knew she was a strong, healthy young woman, and we thought maybe 3 weeks of backpacking. There's just that mythology of, you know, get out in nature. And many of us have had experiences where we've had some experience in nature that sure. has been revelatory or healing or mm-hmm. all of the above. So that was part of it. It was, you know, they were supposed to be master's level counselors out there with her. It was actually run by a PhD level psychologist. So there were people that appeared to have credentials. They were one of the, that program was one of the very first that was accredited. Mm-hmm. So like hospitals that you go to, that seemed to be. Mm-hmm. So on paper, they looked like a very sound therapeutic choice. We took months to research this decision mm-hmm. and talk to different programs. I will say that, you know, like we looked at an Outward Bound, a more intensive Outward Bound. And to their credit, with our honesty about where Erica was at, you know, they said this is not a good fit.
Is that in reference to drug issues?
Drug issues and probably the suicidal uh-huh. ideation, you
I
know,
see.
That.
Okay.
So I would think.
Mm-hmm. But if I'm hearing you right also, Cynthia, it sounds like by the time you had reached the place where you were looking for something like this, you had also tried a lot of more, quote unquote, traditional psychologists and stuff.
Family therapy, you know, as I said, psychologists, psychiatrists, some medication, different schools because she mm-hmm. had been asked to leave mm-hmm. more mm-hmm. than one school. That's another story. But we were triers, you know.
Thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. I ask in part because, Michaela, for me, a lot of what Cynthia is alluding to here speaks to what ends up being a really central thread in the film that we've already talked about a little bit, which is the questionable methods and the underqualified staff who were running these programs. In the case of the other two central figures in the documentary, that also led to sexual assault and abuse because some of these people were known sex offenders who had not received background checks. How did you arrive, Michaela, at the feeling that the nature of the staffing and the lack of oversight in the staffing was something you really wanted to highlight in the film itself?
I met with a lot of survivors and a lot of people in making this film. I've been, you know, working on it for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And the words that continuously came up from so many conversations was accountability. A lot of these programs had closed. So great, they closed them, but the programs would shut down. Those people would move across state lines and go work somewhere else with new children. You know, in Rob Cooley's case, who ran Catherine Freer, I mean, there were multiple deaths after Erica's, and they continued to run for another decade. That's the pattern that has happened with the people who work in these programs for decades.
Well, Michaela Schwer is the filmmaker of The Kids Are Not All Right, the documentary that tells the story of several people who suffered at the hands of these abusive residential schools for quote-unquote troubled teens. including Cynthia Harvey's daughter, Erica. The film is showing at the Phoenix Film Festival Summer Series on August 4th. And thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that is it for this Friday edition of the show. We'll be back on Monday morning. I hope you have a great weekend. And remember, you can sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It's called Radio Heads, and you can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. Our handle is at @kjzztheshow. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, and Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.